I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, an epidemic of amputations that could have been prevented. We'll spend this hour with journalist Sophie Novak, who visited one of the poorest and least insured communities in the country, where almost one in three residents has diabetes. Without resources to keep the disease under control, one county has an amputation rate that is 4 times the national average. We'll hear about why millions of Americans who have diabetes don't realize it until they've suffered irreversible harm, and about how amputations affect the well-being of entire families. Our conversation starts after a short break. If you picture the state of Texas, the area called the Rio Grande Valley is at the southernmost tip, bordered by the river to the south, the Gulf of Mexico to the east. Agriculture is big business there, especially citrus fruit. But lately, the valley is gaining national attention for producing an epidemic of diabetic amputations. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tiny Willacy County alone, population about 22,000, has an amputation rate 4 times the national average. And as my guest will explain, many people in the valley are resigned to the fact that sooner or later diabetes will disrupt or even end their lives because they just can't access the kind of health care needed to keep their body's sugar levels under control. Sophie Novak is a reporter with the Texas Observer. Her recent article is called Life and Limb, Inside the Rio Grande Valley's Amputation Crisis. She joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin to talk about it. Sophie, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you open this story with a guy named Daniel Zamora. He's a legal permanent resident, but he's pretty much never had the kind of job that comes with benefits. So what does he do when he's sick?
Generally, he doesn't really do much of anything. He tries to cure himself. So if he gets cuts or blisters, he uses rubbing alcohol, different kind of ointments. He has a moringa tree outside his front door. So sometimes he'll brew some tea from the leaves of that. If things get really bad, he'll ultimately occasionally go to the emergency room. But that's really kind of the last resort. He doesn't have health insurance, so he can't pay for it. And the way that he describes it is, you know, doctors make these kind of snide remarks to him if he ever does go to the emergency room. So he generally tries to avoid that.
Snide remarks because he's uninsured.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How did he find out he had diabetes?
He found out about 10 years ago now, but he found out because he was accessing, he was going to the doctor for something else, and they ended up testing it. But they believe that he had the disease for a while before that and just wasn't aware of it, and so wasn't having any treatment or managing the diabetes.
His parents had both died of diabetes, though, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So does he describe it as a kind of cognitive dissonance? Like, did he think, well, I have it, but it's not going to hurt me in some way?
Yeah, he just didn't really think too much of it. It's so common in the Rio Grande Valley and in Cameron County where he lives. Nearly 30% of adults in the Rio Grande Valley are diabetic. And so many people that folks know there have the disease, and it's just generally kind of considered a way of life there, especially for folks who have this kind of family history of it. And so when he first was diagnosed, he just didn't think too much of it until he started having these bad complications that came with it, and now he takes it much more seriously.
So his amputation started with a blister on his toe, which is like the kind of thing that happens to everybody now and then, like your shoes are too tight or whatever. First of all, will you explain for us why people with uncontrolled diabetes are at greater risk from wounds to their feet than other people would be?
Sure. There's first the element that it can kind of restrict blood flow to the area, and so the body is less able to heal the blister or the cut itself. A second part of that is that diabetic-related nerve damage can mean that the person that has that injury just doesn't really feel it. And so they might not realize that they have any kind of cut until it gets infected and until it gets to a point where, it's a more severe situation.
What made Daniel realize he needed medical care?
It took a while. So he was kind of watching this blister develop. You know, it happened when his sneaker rubbed against his foot, like happens to all of us, you know, as a regular thing. And that kind of thing had happened to him before. He'd kind of tried to manage it himself before, but this time it didn't go away. And it started, he describes it as his toe kind of started turning black. And that color kind of started moving towards the rest of his foot. And still for a while, you know, he tried some ointments, he tried some rubbing alcohol. And eventually, after a number of weeks, he did go to the emergency room.
So when his toe turned black, that was gangrene, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So first he went to the emergency room. They gave him some medicine. It wasn't enough to cure him at that point.
That's right.
Yeah. So he had to have some toes amputated. And in addition to like the pain and suffering there, the surgery cost him his job. And it also had an effect on his adult son.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that I've heard a lot talking to folks in the Rio Grande Valley who are dealing with this. So when Daniel had his toes amputated, for a while he couldn't walk very well. And another kind of element of this is for a lot of these folks who are uninsured, who don't have a lot of money, if they do have to have an amputation like this, they can't necessarily afford follow-up wound care. And so they have to kind of take care of that themselves, or family members have to pitch in and help them. So for Daniel, he couldn't go back to work. He was at the time working cleaning a gym near his house. And he couldn't do that because he couldn't walk and he couldn't lift weights or move around too well. And so he was basically stuck at home, and his son came by each day to help him, rewrap the wound, clean it out, etc.
So how is he getting by these days?
He's all right. Whenever I ask him how he's doing, he says surviving. Mm-hmm. And you know, when he asks me how I'm doing, that's often kind of posed the same way, but as a question, how are you surviving? He's doing a lot better, so he can walk around just fine now. He takes walks around the block where he lives. He does still kind of lose his balance a little bit. He describes that as wobbling like an egg. For the most part, he's doing better as far as the amputation, but he also has vision problems that are related to the diabetes. And he does not have a high school diploma. And so those kind of physical impairments combined, with his lack of degree, make it difficult for him to find a new job. So right now he's relying on disability payments from the government. And he is trying to get his diabetes under control, but that's really difficult. He has health insurance now because his disability has qualified him for Medicare and Medicaid, but he still doesn't have a lot of money. And so, you know, he says he can't really afford too much healthy food. And it's just a difficult habit to break, to really completely change his eating habits and, exercise to the point that he needs to. And so he's still kind of struggling to get his diabetes under control. And he is at a high risk of further complications like amputations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of people who have had one diabetic amputation that subsequently will need another.
That's right. And a large part of that is because sometimes, you know, folks can't afford that follow-up wound care. And so those wounds can get reinfected and they'll need to have a further amputation.
Okay, let's talk about why uncontrolled diabetes is such a particular problem in the Rio Grande Valley. First of all, you mentioned earlier that something like 30% of people there have diabetes. 32% more have what's called pre-diabetes. What is that?
That basically means kind of they're on the path towards diabetes without, any kind of big change. So blood sugar levels are high, and they could end up developing diabetes if they don't make a kind of big lifestyle change and get it under control.
A lot of people living in the Valley are of Latino descent. Does anybody know why Latinos living in the U.S. have a higher than average risk for diabetes?
It's kind of a combination of things. So part of diabetes is genetic, and people, folks aren't really sure why some people develop it, some don't, but part of it is genetic. And so Latinos do have a higher risk for developing diabetes. And then part of it is lifestyle. And so, types of food that people eat, level of activity, etc. And then in this area in particular, it is one of the poorest areas in the U.S. and one of the least insured areas in the U.S. And so folks aren't regularly accessing the kind of medical care that would help them prevent this kind of disease and also would give them the kind of awareness and education about it in order to try to prevent it and manage it themselves.
I was surprised to learn that there are like millions of people in the United States who are believed to probably have diabetes but haven't yet been diagnosed. It would seem like if you had diabetes, you would know it. How does it end up going unnoticed for so long?
So for a lot of the people that I wrote about in this story, it's not having access to medical care. So if people are uninsured or otherwise just not going to the doctor, they don't really have that opportunity to get that diagnosis and to realize that. And that could be, they're uninsured. It could be that they're focused on work or raising a family and just aren't going to get that kind of medical care.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. By the time people do have symptoms that make them realize they have to go to the doctor, is that damage permanent, whatever their, vision problems or whatever problems they're experiencing?
Not necessarily. Diabetes is generally manageable if folks make the kind of necessary lifestyle changes, if they have access to necessary medication, to insulin, et cetera. It's not necessarily permanent. In some of these cases that I've written about, it has ended up being that way because it has gone undiagnosed and untreated for so long that it does end up in complications like these kinds of infections that require amputations or like partial blindness, full blindness, that are not reversible at that point.
One thing that's been really distressing to doctors is seeing younger and younger people coming in with complications from diabetes. Is there any understanding of why that might be happening?
It's generally a trend across the United States that folks are being diagnosed with diabetes younger and younger or developing diabetes younger and younger, in part tied to it's a range of factors, but in part tied to rising rates of obesity. And that can be the case in kids as well. And in the Rio Grande Valley, it's all of these kinds of risk factors are exacerbated. And so there are generally people, if folks are diagnosed with diabetes when they are younger, they're more likely to develop these complications and more likely to develop them when they're younger.
What kind of care is necessary to help someone who's been diagnosed with diabetes keep the disease under control? Because if I understand correctly, if you keep the disease under control, you don't necessarily suffer a lot of the permanent health effects.
Yeah, so a lot of it is kind of lifestyle changes like diet and exercise, depending on kind of the level of the disease, that can be enough to manage it. Some folks need to have insulin, which is going in a different direction here, but that's another issue here where we've seen across the United States these skyrocketing insulin prices, even if folks do have insurance. But that's another way to manage the disease. And so we've seen in the Rio Grande Valley some kind of community efforts to try to address this. A lot of those are focused on prevention, so catching this early, catching it when folks have prediabetes or early stages of diabetes and encouraging those kinds of lifestyle changes. There's also been, the development of farmers markets, the creation of walking trails, things like that.
So it's the kind of thing that honestly it sounds like a whole community sort of needs to get behind.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of this is really education and awareness.
My guest is reporter Sophie Novak. She's with the Texas Observer. We're talking about her recent piece, Life and Limb. It's about the rash of diabetic amputations happening, particularly in the Rio Grande Valley in the United States. But it turns out that amputations as a consequence of diabetes are on the rise all over the country. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are at KERA Think. We'll be right back. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Texas Observer reporter Sophie Novak about her piece Life and Limb, which is about a rising rate of diabetic amputations in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas and around the country. If you've got experience in dealing with the healthcare system in conjunction with your own diabetes or that of a loved one, or you've got a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Sophie, amputations had been related to complications of diabetes had been declining for 20 years, and then recently, over the past few years, they've started rising again. Does anybody have a good explanation for that?
Yeah, so that was interesting to see in the course of reporting this story. That was a study that came out from it was published in Diabetes Care in November, and that was kind of in my course of reporting this. And so that kind of put this in perspective that we are seeing this on a broader national scale. The study didn't really draw specific conclusions as to what could be causing that. You know, there are a number of factors that researchers have pointed to as far as explaining the rise in diabetes more broadly. And so CDC researchers have found that the number of adults diagnosed with diabetes in the United States has quadrupled between 1980 and 2014. And they're now projecting that that number will nearly triple by 2060. And so that kind of, you know, some factors involved in that are, you know, folks getting diagnosed with diabetes younger, these kind of skyrocketing rates of obesity across the country, a growing Latino population who are, you know, at a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. There are a number of things that folks are kind of thinking about there. And when you have higher rates of diabetes and you have folks both developing diabetes when they're younger and then living longer, that kind of results in a greater number of these kinds of complications like amputations.
A doctor told you that, I mean, this is very frustrating for healthcare professionals, right? I mean, because they know that a lot of these amputations in particular are preventable with the proper care. One doctor said, we should think of every diabetic amputation as a failure of the U.S. healthcare system. What did he mean by that?
So I think it is important to say that in a number of circumstances, the amputation is medically necessary. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that the amputation itself shouldn't happen in that specific instance. Often a person having that amputation will end up saving their life because it'll prevent the infection from spreading throughout their body. I think it's more that, you know, we should never really be getting to this point where a person needs to have that amputation in the first place. And a lot of that is because type 1 and type 2 diabetes are generally very manageable with the right care and the right kind of preventive measures. And so if someone is, you know, having regular access to healthy food, is regularly exercising, is regularly, you know, seeing a doctor and has those kinds of resources to deal with this, it should never really be getting to a point in which that amputation is necessary.
Earlier, you mentioned something called a wound care center. What is that, and how does it play into the chances that diabetics can survive an infection without an amputation?
Yeah, so we've seen more wound care centers crop up across the valley in recent years, and they're basically places that will treat these kinds of severe wounds like Daniel Zamora had, to try to prevent an amputation. So if a diabetic patient gets an ulcer or a cut that gets infected, trying to catch that early enough and trying to clean it out, to treat it, to encourage the patient to stay home from work, stay off their feet, in the hopes that, you know, that wound will heal without having to lose the toe or the foot or the leg.
That the advice to stay home, it makes perfect sense. It's not always an option for people who are working jobs where if they don't show up or they're not standing, they don't get paid.
That's right. Yeah. And another doctor in the Rio Grande Valley described that area to me as high work, low income. And so for a lot of these families, you know, they really depend on the paycheck that comes with work in order to put food on the table and pay rent and support their families. And so the kind of direction of, you know, stay home from work is seems simple enough, but a lot of folks aren't really able to heed that if they have families to take care of.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Greg calling us from Houston. Hi, Greg.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. I'm a podiatrist. I work at some of the hospitals here in Houston, and I see a large population of diabetics with gangrene, infections, ulcers, and such. And what I come across quite often having to do with the disease has to do with the peripheral neuropathy that's present and the absence of feedback to the brain on pain and other conditions that happen within the foot and leg.
So, excuse me for interrupting. This is the nerve damage. Yeah. That means you don't feel it if you've got a wound on your leg or your foot. If you have this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. People will come in, they've had a tack in their foot for 3 or 4 weeks or 2 weeks, and it's all infected, and they didn't know it. Hmm. And family member has brought them in because of the something on the that they've seen or smelled or something along that line, but they're not aware of it. So there's a my whole goal in speaking with anybody that's had an amputation is advocacy. I try to address someone in the family, a spouse, loved one, son, daughter, whoever, that can look at their feet at least every other day, make sure they take the medications according to schedule, have their appointments followed up, those kinds of things. And she's right, prevention is huge on this, because sometimes we see a cut that can be treated initially, and then it goes on to become infected, and then it gets into the bone and spreads. And, you know, whereas something could have been handled possibly easier with an antibiotic and some local wound care, ends up IV antibiotics, kidney damage, loss of more of the foot or the leg. And then the comorbidities that come along with that as well. There are people that I kind of coined this phrase, type 3 diabetes. I know it's not out there, but I kind of coined it for my group that has a pronounced peripheral neuropathy, pronounced vascular disease, and they're just no longer capable, I don't mean from an intellectual standpoint, but capable of taking care of their feet.
Yeah. Well, Greg, thank you so much for your call. You've put a lot out there for us, and I really appreciate the good advice that you were giving. Is that the kind of thing, Sophie, that you heard from physicians in working in the Valley?
Yeah, definitely, very much so. And I think it's interesting, you know, he brings up both kind of the family member aspect and the element of these kind of other effects of the disease at the same time as this kind of issue. And, you know, I met one woman in the Rio Grande Valley named Carmen who, you know, she didn't really start accessing regular treatment until her diabetes was very far along. She ended up having to have a few toes amputated, and, you know, now she regularly checks her feet, but because of the diabetes, she's also blind. And so that was part of not, you know, she didn't catch the infection early enough to prevent the amputation, in part because she didn't really feel it, but she also couldn't see it. And so it wasn't until, you know, her daughter saw it and was like, oh my God, your toe looks like a mummy toe. We have to go to the doctor. And so that's just kind of another added layer of complication here for folks that have a number of these effects from the disease.
Something else that comes up in the piece, we mentioned those wound care centers that can help people when these serious wounds develop. Not every community has one of these places.
That's right, yeah. And a few years ago, and I would say that's another kind of just general trend in the Rio Grande Valley, is there are not, when we talk about there not being healthcare access to the same extent as there are in other parts of the state or other parts of the country, part of that is just not having as many places to go to access medical care. And so a number of years ago, there were not wound care centers, and diabetic patients would need to travel to places like San Antonio, you know, traveling several hours in order to access this kind of care. And so I talked to a doctor there, Dr. Oliveira, who opened the first wound care center in the Valley, and he also was a co-founder of the Rio Grande Valley Diabetes Association there.
And maybe a little bit like Greg, the podiatrist who called us, Dr. Oliveira is always straight with his patients because he knows how important it is.
That's right.
Yeah. One woman told you that losing a limb is like losing a family member. Like, there's also an emotional trauma in addition to the physical loss and the disability that comes with an amputation.
Very much so. And that's something I heard from a lot of patients that I spoke to there, that, and a lot of folks are depressed. You know, it can feel very isolating. They were formerly very active, self-sufficient, et cetera, and are now relying on family members to take care of them. They can't move around and do all the just general things that we kind of take for granted, you know, day to day because of this.
And because the incidence of wounds serious enough to require amputations are starting to affect younger and younger people, which is to say young adults, adults in midlife, there's a huge ripple effect on their families. Sometimes their teenagers have to quit high school and start working to support the family.
Yeah, that's kind of this domino effect that I've heard a lot happening there. And I think one good example of that is in Dr. Oliveira's wound clinic in Edinburgh, Texas, in the Valley. One day that I was there reporting this story, I met a patient, Israel Guerra, who was there with his daughter, Esmeralda, his adult daughter. And he had, a while back, had half of one of his feet amputated due to diabetes. And then just a few months before I met him, had had half of his other leg amputated. And when that happened, his daughter Esmeralda had to quit her waitressing job to help take care of him, help her mom, you know, look after him and take care of the wound and make sure that he heals properly. And so that's kind of this domino effect when something like this happens on other family members, of having to, you know, drop out of school, leave their jobs, et cetera, in order to help care for their family members.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go back to the phones. We have Ellen calling now from San Antonio. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm a retired registered nurse. I've been a type 2 diabetic for about 15 years. I have excellent insurance because I have Medicare with a full coverage GAP plan, and I have Part D, and I cannot afford my diabetic medications, the ones that keep me in such good control that I don't have to worry about infections, blindness, or neuropathy. The way that the Part D is set up, it uses up my benefit within 4 months, and for the next 7 months, I'm expected to pay $700 to $800 a month out of pocket on a disability income for my medications. And that's for everybody. Everybody who's dealing with serious chronic illness on Part D gets only $3,500 to $3,900 worth of coverage and then has $5,000 out of pocket they have to cover before they're covered again. So I'm dismayed that Medicare will pay for me to lose my leg, have physical therapy and visits and everything that I need if I lose my leg, but they won't pay for the medication to keep me from losing my leg.
Ellen, I'm so sorry to hear how hard it's been for you. Sophie, that sounds like a story that you've heard from other people as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point. You know, I mentioned this earlier that we've seen skyrocketing insulin prices. And so even for folks that have insurance coverage, many are not able to pay for it out of pocket or pay for the out of pocket costs that come with that medication.
What does it take for people to be fitted with a prosthetic limb after an amputation?
So there's a period in there before someone is able to get a prosthetic. So Mr. Guerra that I mentioned earlier, who had his leg just above his knee was amputated in November, he now has coverage. He has Medicare, and that's because he now is qualified through disability. So his, you know, his disease and his complications have now made him eligible for this coverage, and he is going to be getting a prosthetic leg through his insurance, but it is a several month waiting period before that can happen to make sure that that wound is fully healed before he can get that fitted.
Let's go back to the phones. 800-933-5372 is our number. Alex is on the line in Houston. Hi, Alex.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 44 years old, and I was diagnosed as pre-diabetic in 2017. I completely changed my diet and my, you know, my way of living, exercising a lot more. I've always been an avid guy, mountain biking. It's never really been in our family genetically. But I've since dropped my A1C. But my question is, are there any symptoms or anything that anybody should feel aware of that would make them want to go to the doctor to get that tested? Because sometimes in the wintertime, especially, like, my extremities feel really cold, and I don't know if that's a cause of that. So, like, my hands and feet will be really cold in the winter. They don't tend to warm up, and I wonder if that's a blood circulation problem.
Well, Alex, thanks for calling. And before we hear from Sophie, I want to stress that she's not a physician. She's a journalist. But Sophie, maybe you have some information that could help.
Thanks, Chris. I was going to stress that as well. I'm not sure about that. But I do think, I guess I'll share another story in the course of reporting this article. I met with a woman who was an associate professor at a university in the Rio Grande Valley, who was running this kind of clinic at a flea market there in order to help folks catch the disease early on. And she is, you know, she's fit. She clearly knows a lot about this. She's very well educated in terms of diabetes and diabetes prevention. And she was testing one of the machines there one day at the clinic and found that she was pre-diabetic. And so that's kind of just indicative of the importance of just, you know, understanding what that means, understanding what it means to have a healthy lifestyle, and then just having regular access to be able to see the doctor in order to, you know, get that kind of diagnosis, if that is the case.
My guest is Texas Observer reporter Sophie Novak. We're talking about her recent article, Life and Limb. It's about the increase in amputations being performed on people because of diabetes-related wounds. They're happening more and more in the Texas Rio Grande Valley and also in other parts of the country. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter. We are at KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Sophie Novak of the Texas Observer. We're talking about her recent piece, Life and Limb, which looks at the significant increase in diabetic amputations in the Rio Grande Valley. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We did hear from a listener via email who asked that we differentiate between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder. Type 2 diabetes is one that is often related to lifestyle issues. And I appreciate that the notation to make a difference, to recognize the difference between the two. I will say there's a lot of stigma attached to type 2 diabetes. I wonder if that keeps people from seeking care, even when it is available, Sophie.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think we see that even kind of from government officials recently. Folks in the Trump administration have said, you know, when we're talking about kind of a different healthcare plans and what we're kind of spending money on. You know, there's been some comments made by some officials saying, you know, we're not going to support folks kind of sitting on the couch and you know, eating junk food, et cetera. I definitely think there's a lot of stigma attached to that. And I think it's important to realize that there are a number of different factors that come into play here that result in someone having type 2 diabetes, genetic, lifestyle, you know, family history, et cetera. And I think it's important to kind of bust that stigma there and recognize that, you know, there's a lot that we can do in terms of preventing and managing that disease and helping a lot of people.
There is an education component to successfully managing type 2 diabetes. What kind of programs exist in the Valley to help people deal with the diabetes diagnosis?
Yeah, so there are a lot. Because this is such a prevalent issue in that area, there are a lot of different community efforts that address this. One that I talk about in the story is called the Salute Vita program, and that's a partnership of a number of different universities, nonprofits, doctors, etc. And the idea is the program is intended for folks who do have uncontrolled diabetes to help with a series of seven classes dedicated to how to get, you know, what kind of changes they can make, what kind of medication they need, et cetera. And then also having a promotora or a community health worker in the area come to their house every few months and test their blood sugar, kind of help them in figuring out how to get their diabetes under control. So that's one example, but it really is a community-wide effort, especially in this area, to help folks out in this way.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Linda is on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a question about the gentleman that didn't have any health care insurance in the Rio Grande Valley, and I'm kind of puzzled as far as his eligibility for the Obamacare. It may be going down right now, but I'm sure at one point it must have been affordable for him.
Thanks for calling. What do you know about that, Sophie?
Yeah, so he actually falls into what we call the Medicaid gap. So the ACA, created this Medicaid expansion program that states could opt into. Texas is one of, I believe, about 14 remaining that have not elected to expand Medicaid, and that would cover folks like this gentleman who are very poor. And so right now he falls into this area where he is too poor to qualify for subsidies that would help him purchase private insurance from the ACA exchanges. And so he's one of actually about 100,000 folks that live just in the Rio Grande Valley who would be eligible for Medicaid if Texas were to expand Medicaid under the ACA.
We have an email here from John who writes, I've been diabetic since childhood and nothing is scarier than randomly losing your insurance. It's a stressful situation on top of a stressful lifestyle. Your bills stack up because it's critical to have blood work done almost monthly. Depression from these situations swells and smothers. You feel like a melting person pestering other people. It's a downward spiral. And watching the cost of insulin skyrocket only makes us suffer more. Being a child and growing up to see the dark future ahead of me only makes me sad. And it feels like the government doesn't care. Wow. There's a lot of suffering and a lot of emotion wrapped up in that email, Sophie.
There is definitely, yeah. I'm sorry to hear that, and thank you for sharing.
What happens to people who find themselves in a critical situation, don't have health insurance, and their illness is related to diabetes? Who pays for their care in that point?
So it depends on exactly kind of their situation. I found, according to state data, looking at kind of years 2014 to 2016, that there were about 32,000 hospital discharges due to diabetic amputations. And so about half of those were covered by Medicare. So that's insurance through the government. About 15% of those were uninsured patients like Daniel, who we were talking about earlier. And in that case, you know, if someone's going to the emergency room and doesn't have health insurance, the hospital has to see them anyway. And so often those costs are absorbed by the hospital itself. And what we've seen in Texas in the last several years is many, many closures of rural hospitals in the state. There have been about 20 rural hospital closures across Texas in the last several years. And a large part of that, advocates say, is due to these kind of uncompensated care costs. So the hospital being on the hook for a lot of that, a lot of that cost.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Kathleen calling from San Antonio. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you ask your reporter there if there's any way we can deal with the trouble with having Medicare send you your vials, your test strips, if you look, if people don't usually read these things, it's supposed to be between 41 degrees and 86 degrees is the limit. And if it gets higher or even a higher humidity level, I'm just looking at my new vial of 58%, which means three-quarters of Texas doesn't account for this. You're supposed to keep it in low humidity and between 41 degrees and 86 degrees. And
Kathleen, thank you so much. I hear your frustration, and you're right. Most of Texas, you'd have to cross your fingers to get those conditions met. I don't know if you looked into the way that supplies are delivered to folks who are on Medicare, Sophie.
That's not something that I've looked into.
But it is, I guess, when you have this disease, you're sort of looking at a lifetime of having to be really well educated about all the things you need to do to take care of yourself.
That's right, and I think it can be very overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you bring up that I wouldn't have thought about is that some people just don't have the resources to even see the same healthcare professionals over the years. So even if they're on and off insurance and they have some care, maybe there's nobody like tracking their progress or their decline over time.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, particularly in this area where a lot of folks are uninsured, where a lot of people rely on community health centers, different kinds of health clinics where it's more kind of, going in, there can be long waits for that kind of care. And if you don't have this kind of consistent health insurance where you're seeing the same doctor, it's just kind of whoever's available, if you're even able to access that kind of care at all. And so I've heard a lot of people in the Valley kind of talk about these, cultural explanations in terms of this frustration of many people there, being kind of wary of doctors or not wanting to take their medication, et cetera. And I think it's important to note that is very much tied to these kind of more systemic problems and this kind of network of different health providers that exists in a place like that where, people aren't necessarily accessing the same doctor and getting kind of the same type of care regularly.
Right. And then sometimes the result is that people are taking advice from a friend or a family member who may mean well but doesn't have the qualifications to actually tell someone how to manage their diabetes.
That's right. And that's something that I heard a lot from many doctors there as a really big frustration of saying, I'm trying to help you here, but your neighbor doesn't know how to deal with a kind of wound in the same way that I, a medical professional, would.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, we'll go back to the phones now. Daniel is calling us from Georgetown, Texas. Hi, Daniel.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a diabetic for 22 years, and I really didn't take it serious until I became diagnosed as being a stage 3 kidney disease.
Hmm.
And so I started going to a specialist, and one of the first things that I came out of that first meeting with that really made an impression is that when you first go to a doctor, they normally talk about medication and diet and exercise. Diet and exercise was so important. Since I had that advice and since I was slapped in the face with the diagnosis, it really made an impression. I've changed my eating habits. I've changed my exercise habits. I've dropped 32 pounds. I've gone from 5 pills and 50 milligrams of long-lasting insulin, I'm a type 2 diabetic, down to my lisinopril and 10 units of Lantus. So I just wanted to, the exercise and diet is such a key part to controlling your diabetes.
Well, radio high five to you, Daniel, and I hope that you continue to stay healthy and gain more health. That's really fantastic news. It's a reminder, Sophie, that diabetes can feel like this big, scary thing, and it is, but it is, with proper care and proper attention to one's health and good habits, we do have some power to make it better.
That's definitely true. It's definitely true. And I think it's also important to recognize that, something like that can seem pretty simple can be much more difficult for folks that are in different situations, that don't have access to the same kind of healthy foods or the same kind of resources. That being said, if we focus on prevention and we focus on education and emphasizing kind of the even incremental kind of changes that people can make in order to manage a situation like this, that's very important.
How did you first become aware that this was a thing, that there was a particular rise in amputation rates in the Rio Grande Valley? And were you surprised as you dug in further that it was worse than you had thought originally?
That's an interesting question. I actually first heard about this from a researcher at a UT public health school in Brownsville, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley. And I was there a while back reporting a different story that was about Zika in the valley. And I was meeting a researcher there for coffee, and she just mentioned this, and it wasn't something she had any really kind of specifics on. She didn't have, you know, the data that she showed me to back this up. It was more, you know, we've worked on these kinds of diabetes prevention programs, and this is something I see a lot. And that's kind of where this started, was talking to a lot of doctors, talking to a lot of people there, and kind of getting a picture of it as something that people just see in their daily life to such a great extent there. And then it was, you know, bringing in data from the state health department that showed that, yes, this is in fact the case. You know, this is a major issue in this area.
Is there reason to think that the valley is truly unique, or does your reporting suggest there might be pockets of like uncontrolled diabetes and lots of amputations in communities elsewhere in the country?
I think I focused on this area because it is so stark, but I definitely think it's important to emphasize that this is not just happening in the valley, and we see that with the dramatic rises in the number of diabetes cases across the country, the rise that we now seem to be seeing in diabetic amputations specifically across the country. So I think this is kind of a microcosm of this problem, but it's certainly not only in this area.
You mentioned communities are like putting in walking trails and farmers markets. Are members of these communities thinking about these as like civic issues?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think it's a frustration for people in this area that are working on this. So, you know, a lot of advocates and researchers are emphasizing things like farmers markets, things like hike and bike trails. And those are important kind of first steps, but with, you know, the major caveat that in order to really address this, we need kind of a bigger shift in terms of how we think about healthcare and how we think about disease prevention and disease management in terms of people really having access to the resources necessary.
Sophie Novak is a reporter with the Texas Observer. Her recent article is called Life and Limb: Inside the Rio Grande Valley's Amputation Crisis. Sophie, thank you so much for making time to speak with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is @KERATHINK. My personal Twitter handle is @ChrisBoydThink. You can use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast. We have 9 new episodes every week. And you can find out about upcoming shows we have planned at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.